Greetings and welcome to the podcast channel of the Major Contemporary Strategic Issues Chair. The theme for 2024 is Confrontations and Strategic Recompositions. This episode is an extract from a lecture given by Maran Kamrava, Professor of International and Regional Relations, Georgetown University, Doha, Qatar. The conference is entitled The Emergence of the Persian Gulf and the New Balance of Power in the Middle East. Don't hesitate to subscribe to our podcast or YouTube channel to keep up to date with all our publications. We hope you enjoy listening.
Monsieur, thanks for that warm introduction. It is a pleasure and an honor being here. I am most grateful to Sorbonne for this kind invitation, and particularly to the organizers for their brilliant organization.
Il peut dire en même siglet.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yes, yes.
That French shirt.
As you know, in the Middle East, we pride ourselves in hospitality, and I think we have a few things to learn from the French. So, my sincere thanks. I apologize for delivering this lecture in English and not in French. You would not want to hear me in French, I assure you. I say this with a little bit of reluctance. We're at a historic moment in the Persian Gulf, certainly at an inflection point. And I say it with reluctance because we hear that term again and again. If we were speaking about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and probably 5 or 10 years from now, we would be talking about being at a historic moment, because things change so dramatically and so rapidly and so unpredictably in the Middle East at large, and particularly in the Persian Gulf, that it is all historic moments. But there are a few indications right now, particularly over the last 2-3 years, that have really changed things and are likely to have significant consequences in the forthcoming years. Particularly beginning in 2020, 2021, a good reference point, historic reference point, would be COVID. Right smack during COVID, as COVID was ravaging the region, the Middle East and countries around the Persian Gulf, particularly Iran, things began to change rather dramatically. And things began to, we begin to see a number of historic and important changes. So one of the things we see is that there are some major changes occurring in the security arrangements in the Persian Gulf. But at the same time, there are a number of very important continuities. And what I want to do tonight is to very briefly share amongst ourselves some of the important factors that are changing, particularly beginning with the how the region looks right now as we look at it. What are some of the important security issues that are shaping assumptions in the Persian Gulf, in regional capitals, not necessarily from the outside, but by the actors that are important and relevant? Those actors, of course, are first and foremost Washington, then, of course, Saudi Arabia and what's happening there. We have a very important actor, often called the Little Sparta, United Arab Emirates, the country where I have been living since 2007, Qatar, of course, the regional power, Iran, is quite important. And then I will end with a couple of thoughts as to what we're likely to see in the coming years. So I will be as brief as possible. You said speak for as long as you want. You don't want to say that to a professor because we'll speak endlessly, but I'll keep it as brief as possible. Let me just set the scene and kind of share with you what some of the important regional factors are. First of all, if we look at the Middle East, particularly prior to October 7, one of the things we see is that there is a sense of enough conflict, particularly in regional countries like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. These are countries that up until October 7, 2023, are emerging out of important conflicts and are kind of coming out of conflict. The United States also is trying to, in many ways, recover from the Trump era, but the United States is also deeply committed to presence, security and military presence in the Persian Gulf. Now, in March of 2023, we had that major reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And earlier in 2021, we had had reconciliation between Iran and the United Arab Emirates. This occurred right smack during COVID. It was kind of part of this process of region recovering from COVID, where we had these rapprochements between Iran and Saudi Arabia and Iran and the United Arab Emirates. And one of the primary reasons for the UAE, for Saudi Arabia, for Iran, was because each of the policymakers in these countries wanted to focus on delivering on the economic promises that had brought them to power. President Raisi was elected in Iran on the two promises of ending COVID or mass vaccination and then stopping the Iranian currency, the rial, from sliding. Saudi Arabia, of course, became all concerned about Vision 2030. I'll mention that in a bit. And of course, the UAE is trying to develop at breakneck speed. So economic priorities became the dominant policy objective of each of the leaders in the regional countries. But this was not to say that they put aside their animosities and particularly their competition. The UAE and Qatar and Bahrain, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, all of these countries are trying to compete with one another for economic development. The pie, if you will, is finite, and they're going after a finite pie. Having said this, of course, in order to focus domestically, you would have to focus on regional de-escalation and to de-escalate regional tensions as much as possible so you could focus inward and on economic development. So, what are some of the overarching security issues within this context of focusing on economic development, trying to reduce regional tensions? And so what are some of the security dynamics that shape the security of the region? Well, we heard towards the end of the Obama administration, we heard the term Asia pivot, that the United States was changing its gaze, changing the direction of its gaze towards Asia. Well, this is not to say that the U.S. decided to ignore or neglect or even lessen its attention to the Middle East or to the Persian Gulf. Although the U.S. now has become a competitor in LNG exports, liquefied natural gas exports to countries like Qatar and, of course, Iran. Nevertheless, the United States remains deeply committed to staying in the region. And this perseverance of the United States has created a deep sense of psychological dependence, particularly among the smaller states. If you're in Bahrain, you welcome American presence. If you're in Qatar, you welcome the American military base. You know that the Americans have the biggest air base outside of the United States, the biggest forward military base outside of the United States in Qatar, actually a few kilometers from where I work and where I live. And that military presence is deeply welcomed and deeply dependent on. And part of this reason is because of the Islamic Republic, because Iran remains a source of mistrust, because Iran is seen as some country that cannot be trusted, whether it's because of sectarian differences or because of Iran's support for non-state actors, for a whole variety of reasons across the Persian Gulf, in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, Bahrain, and to a lesser extent, Kuwait and Oman, there is deep mistrust towards Iran. Now, one of the things we see is that this mistrust towards Iran is not unique, because Qataris don't trust the Saudis. The Saudis don't trust the Emiratis. Qatar and Bahrain don't trust each other. And this has had consequences. There's mistrust by all actors. You remember that from 2017 to 2020, we had the so-called Gulf crisis, where United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain blockaded Qatar and tried to make Qatar change its security and foreign policy somewhat fundamentally. And that, of course, is pervasive. So there's continued mistrust by all actors. Now, we hear a lot of talk about whether or not China is going to become a military power in the Persian Gulf. China is free riding, and China wants the United States to provide security in the waterways of the Persian Gulf so that it can engage in trade and investment and have security in the region, courtesy of the Americans, so it can easily continue to engage in trade and investment. China is a major actor in places like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The Gulf Cooperation Council has declined a great deal. From 2017 to 2020, the GCC was on life support because people in the GCC were actually not even allowed to talk to each other. The Qatari representative and the Bahraini representatives couldn't talk to each other. Now it's no longer on life support. It has been resuscitated, but nonetheless, it is not as active as anymore. And so once you have these multilateral relations collapse, relations have become transactional. So a lot of countries engage in bilateral relations, not out of principle, but out of immediate returns. What's in it for me? What are the immediate, tangible interests that I can gain from dealing with whoever is going to deal with me? Not necessarily out of some overarching principles like Gulf solidarity or Arab solidarity, but out of more immediate and tangible results. And of course, this has become all the more important since October, or since December of 2023, because as we know, the Houthis started attacking shipping lanes, not necessarily in the Persian Gulf, but in the Red Sea. And that, of course, has reverberations for the Arab Peninsula and the Persian Gulf, because all of the countries are involved there. And in particular, of course, Saudi Arabia shares a major coastline in the Red Sea. And for Saudi Arabia, Houthi attacks are quite important and quite consequential. So Now, that is the larger context within which assumptions and security threats and opportunities are being formed in the Persian Gulf. Let us look at what each of the actors that are involved think about the region and how they view and how they base their policies in relation to the Persian Gulf. And let's first look at how things are seen from the perspective of Washington, particularly under the Biden administration. Now, let me just say that in the United States, presidents become known for their foreign policy doctrines. And these foreign policy doctrines are articulated over the course of their presidency. They give speeches, they go before the Congress every year, and they deliver the State of the Union address. And over time, they become known for their doctrine. So we know the Nixon doctrine. It's actually the Nixon-Kissinger doctrine. We have the Carter doctrine, the Reagan doctrine, so on and so forth. Now, Biden, when he came to office, almost immediately and very deliberately, he articulated the Biden doctrine. He didn't wait for it to be articulated over time. And there's two main reasons for this. The primary reason is because he was trying to introduce a new face of the United States to the world. And therefore, immediately, in contrast to the Trump doctrine, he articulated the Biden doctrine within the first year of his presidency. And also, Biden, of course, was a long-term senator. He was vice president for 8 years. He already knew what he wanted or where America stood. And so immediately the Biden doctrine became the guiding doctrine of the State Department. It became what the State Department implemented in terms of American foreign policy. And some of the main features of the Biden doctrine so far, as we have come to know them, are first and foremost a more restrained use of American military in order to preserve America's role in the world. Biden is very traditional. Biden has a sense of America's position in the world. Biden has an assumption about what America needs to do, which is quite traditional. America needs to play a leading role in the world. And in order to play that leading role, every once in a while, America needs to resort to its military might. It needs to be constrained. It cannot do so liberally or gratuitously, but it needs to play a leading role in the United States. This is because, and this is within the context of new competition that occurs. And that competition to the United States comes primarily from China. It comes in the form of China's technological competition to the United States. China is an existential competitor to America's global technological advantage. Now, interestingly, the Biden doctrine was articulated before Russia invaded Ukraine. And in the Biden doctrine, Russia was perceived as a disruptor of international order, as a power that disrupts the traditional international order. And as if to prove Biden right, Putin invaded Ukraine. Now, of course, it's not just Russia and China that the United States needs to be attentive to. North Korea is a nuclear power and uses that nuclear power, its nuclear weapons in terms of testing and in terms of threatening security in the Korean Peninsula. And Iran, if Iran is left unchecked, has the potential of becoming a nuclear proliferator. And Iran, China, and Russia pose one of the greatest threats to the stability of the American political system in terms of the cyber threats that they pose. Russia was quite active in the last presidential election, or at least was rumored to be active in the last presidential election, trying to influence American elections. And of course, Iran is not far behind, and so is China. And of course, there's the ever-present threat of terrorism from these weak states that have proliferated across the Middle East in particular. Weak and fragile states like Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Libya, these become petri dishes for terrorism, where terrorists can engage in all sorts of terrorist activities, and the United States therefore needs to be quite active. So even as you see from this very brief outline of the Biden administration, the Middle East at large and the Persian Gulf in particular play important roles, and America cannot afford to take its attention away from the region. It will need to be attentive to other parts of the world, but it cannot necessarily be unattentive to the Persian Gulf in particular. Now, let's turn our attention to the region, beginning with a country that has been in the news a lot lately. And of course, this has been a country that has had an important leadership transition beginning in 2015. We had a very important transition in the sense that we had a new king, King Salman, and almost soon thereafter, his son Muhammad, Muhammad bin Salman, Muhammad son of Salman, eventually he became heir apparent, but became prime minister and defense minister. And almost immediately, he engaged in a bunch of misadventures that quickly became quite costly. These were misadventures like the invasion of Yemen. Yemen has been a thorn on the side of Saudi Arabia for decades. And the Saudis, or at least Mohammed bin Salman, in hubris, thought he could settle the Yemen problem once and for all, and Yemen became a quagmire. And then there was this unsavory murder of the dissident Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist, and then there was the blockade of Qatar. And all of these became incredibly costly. And one of the things we see since 2021 is that Mohammed bin Salman seems to have grown up. He seems to have done some on-the-job training and realized that these misadventures only bring negative publicity and divert him from his ultimate goal, which is to turn Saudi Arabia into a major global economic power. And so it appears that particularly since 2020, 2021, after Trump, the enabler, left, Mohammed bin Salman has taken a very different approach to international relations, to global politics, to Saudi Arabia's larger profile inside the country and globally. And of course, he remains incredibly popular among the young. Mohammed bin Salman has, as you know, instituted a series of extremely popular measures, allowing women to drive, sponsoring various sporting activities, sponsoring, women's golf and wrestling matches and things that are appeal to the young. And of course, he's become quite young. Having said this, I want to also remind us that Mohammed bin Salman dismantled the Saudi deep state. You remember that he rounded up all the princes and he put them in the Ritz-Carlton, in the Riyadh Ritz-Carlton. This became known as the Night of the Long Knives. And what he did with that, he dismantled, he removed from their jobs all of these princes, members of the ruling family that staffed the different parts of the Saudi state. He removed them because they could be potential competitors. And of course, anyone who didn't find themselves at the Ritz-Carlton became quiet afterwards. But what that did was it changed fundamentally the nature of decision-making in Saudi Arabia, which up until that point had been consensus-based, had a foundation. And so now he's basically the only man standing. And as the only man standing, well, that has its advantages, but it can also have very serious disadvantages, which I'll mention in a minute. For now, the only man standing with no competition, of course, is moving full steam ahead with Vision 2030. Everything that Saudi Arabia does is with an eye towards delivering Vision 2030, this very ambitious, high-impact development that the Saudis want to do. And as a result, for the time being, that has put a hold on regional adventures. Now, I say for now, because do you remember Saddam Hussein? He was also the only man standing. Saddam Hussein, some of us are old enough to remember, he was the darling of the French because he was secular, he was enlightened, he was going up against the Iranian religious fundamentalists. And then we remember what he did after he was done with his invasion of Iran, thanks to all sorts of French weaponry and jets. Then he turned around 2 years from that, 18 months from when he was done with Iran, he invaded Kuwait. And then, of course, he was the butcher of Baghdad in the meanwhile. So I remember Saddam Hussein, and I remember what he did for regime survival, what the depth to which he sank in order to save his hide. And you know what? I'm also reminded of the tragic history of the region. And is Mohammed bin Salman another Saddam Hussein? Let's hope not. But that is always a danger when you're in that kind of a predicament, when you have unlimited power, when you're the darling of the West, when you are willing to do anything and everything for regime survival. Let's hope that that is incorrect, but certainly that is a possibility. But also,
on
with Israel, you might remember that a couple of weeks ago, the Saudi Foreign Ministry released a statement saying we're not going to normalize relations with Israel until there's a Palestinian state, and that seems to have poured cold water on the prospects of normalization. However, I think that's a matter of time. Once the war with Gaza is over, once things go back to normal, to the extent that they can be normal, I think normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel is only a matter of time. For the time being, we have a statesman, and Mohammed bin Salman acting as a global statesman that he wants all of us to see. And let's hope that, in fact, that remains the case. Now, Mohammed bin Salman, of course, and Saudi Arabia are competing greatly with the United Arab Emirates, and there is a slightly different view of regional dynamics and regional security from Abu Dhabi than there is from Riyadh. As you know, Mohammed bin Zayed has now since for about a year, is now the president of the UAE and is calling the shots. And of course, one of the important things that that the United Arab Emirates has tried to do since the Arab Spring uprisings, UAE has been trying to fill the vacuum left by Qatar. Once Qatar severed its ties with its proxy groups in Syria and in Libya, then the UAE stepped in and tried to fill the gap. You might remember that when Muammar Gaddafi's compound was overrun, when the Libyan revolutionaries attacked Muammar Gaddafi's compound, the first flag they put up was not the flag of the free Libyan, of the free Libyans. It was the flag of Qatar as a sign of gratitude for all the weapons that Qatar had sent. Well, in 2013, you will see in a minute, Qatar had a leadership transition. It changed its foreign policy. Libya disintegrated into civil war. And in places like Libya and Yemen, of course, and to a lesser extent, Syria, the UAE stepped in and tried to fill that vacuum. And this is largely because of the competition that I mentioned earlier with its rivals. Now, there's an interesting development in relation to the UAE. All of these states, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, of course, align their foreign policy with the United States. But the United Arab Emirates, for the past 3-4 years, has been trying to exercise what in the UAE they're quite proud of, and they call it strategic autonomy. When the Americans asked the Emiratis to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine, they didn't. In fact, they hosted Putin. So did the Saudis. But deliberately, the Emiratis told the Americans, we like you, we like your weapons, we support you, but we also have strategic autonomy. And we have strategic autonomy because we're a middle power. Now, those of us who study international relations know by any matrix, the United Arab Emirates is considered a small state in terms of demography, in terms of geography, in terms of its capabilities. But that's not how the UAE sees itself. It sees itself as a global middle power on par with, for example, Brazil and India, that can exercise strategic autonomy and tell the Americans, you have your priorities, we have our priorities. And our priorities may not always align. And this is a very new development in Emirati foreign policy. It's only since 2020, 2021 that we see this in relation to the UAE. This strategic autonomy has not always been the case. Now, the Emiratis might exercise strategic autonomy, but the country that I live in is quite aware that it is actually a small state. And as a small state, what it wants is as few adversaries as possible and as many friends as possible. And in order to ensure that, Qatar engages in a foreign policy initiative known as hedging. Hedging comes from gambling. And it is when you place one big bet one way and you place a bunch of smaller bets the opposite way. So your security bet goes with the Americans. You house the biggest American airbase in Doha, and then you maintain relations with Iran, with Hamas, with the Taliban, with whoever, because you cannot afford as a small state to have enemies or adversaries, particularly if you share the world's biggest gas field with Iran. You cannot afford to antagonize the Iranians. And so from the mid-1990s on, Qatar has been pursuing a foreign policy of hedging, whereby it has tried to be friends with everyone. More friends with some people and less friends with others, but at least appear friendly with others. And so this is an incredibly complicated foreign policy that is not without risk, because if you look at it from the outside, it looks quite incoherent. What are you doing talking with the Taliban? Why are you talking to the Iranians? Are you friendly with Hamas? What are you doing housing Hamas? One of the things I've been doing for the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 2 months, I've been getting all these phone calls from reporters. Why is Qatar sponsoring Hamas? And I have to explain, Qatar is a small state. It is not in the business of sponsoring Hamas. It houses Hamas because the Americans want Hamas there. And the Americans don't do anything that antagonizes the Israelis. It's the Israelis and the Americans that want Hamas in Doha. But of course, it's difficult to grasp that. And with hedging comes a lot of reputational risk. And one of the things with hedging is that when you try to maintain open lines of communications with everybody, you become strategically positioned to be a perfect middleman. You become a perfect nexus between people who don't talk to each other. So, for example, if the Americans want to talk to the Taliban, who talks to both the Americans and the Taliban? Ah, it's Qatar. Who talks to both the Americans and the Iranians when they want to swap hostages, swap prisoners? Ah, it's Qatar. Who talks to the Americans and to Hamas? Ah, it's Qatar. So Qatar has deliberately made mediation as a pillar of its foreign policy. Now, having said all of this, I have to say that Qatar doesn't do anything without America's consent. Qatar imports vegetables. For example, if you go to Carrefour in Doha, you see vegetables imported from Iran. That import is with the consent of the American embassy in Qatar. They inform the Americans as to what they're doing because, of course, they don't want to jeopardize their security relations. Now, I'm ending. Let's now look at Tehran, how Tehran sees the region, how Iran sees the region. Well, I mentioned earlier that there was an election in Iran in 2021, in which the current Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, was elected. This engineer, by all accounts, was engineered. This election was engineered in a way to produce a particular result. Every other candidate who was possibly electable was eliminated by the vetting process of the Guardian Council. And Iran, the hybrid authoritarian state, became now a fully authoritarian state. Elections actually have historically meant something in Iran. And every once in a while, they produce surprises. In 1997, they produced a surprise. In 2013 and 2017, they produced a surprise. And the powers that be, the deep state in Iran, if you will, didn't want any surprises in 2021 because the assumption is that the 84-year-old supreme leader might pass away during the tenure of the current president in office. So you want to make sure that there is that everything is set for a possible leadership transition and that there is no factional disunity within the political system so that everyone occupying different positions of power in Iran, the parliament, the president, the revolutionary guard, the bureaucracy, everybody is on the same page. And so there is tremendous factional uniformity within the political system. And this is why Ebrahim Raisi's election was engineered and he came to office. So for the first time since the 1980s in Iran, there is no factionalism in the Iranian state. We don't have reformists and principalists and conservatives. Everybody is now conservative. Everyone who is in power, everyone who is in office now sees the world as the supreme leader does, Ali Khamenei. And how does the supreme leader and therefore the president see the world? Well, you know what? The Iranians say in 2015, we signed a nuclear accord with the European Union and the Americans and China and Russia. And in 2018, the Americans withdrew and the EU didn't have the backbone to stand up to the Americans. So because of the betrayal, we're going to look east. And so one of the official doctrines of Iranian foreign policy is now the look east policy. This doctrine has been in practice for more than a decade, but Raisi has made it a formal doctrine of Iranian foreign policy. Complementing this is good neighborly relations, ensuring that Iran and its neighbors are on good terms, and that Iran and its neighbors have tension reduction. Now, interestingly, you might remember that the former administration of Rouhani tried to reduce tensions with Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, when it proposed the so-called HOPE initiative, H-O-P-E, which stood for Hormuz Peace Endeavor. And there were no takers. But then, of course, after 2020, 2021, Saudi strategic objectives changed and Emirati strategic objective changed. And so the good neighbor policy coming out of Tehran found receptive ears in regional capitals. And so now we have the look east policy and the good neighborly policy. You might remember that a couple of months ago, for the first time, Iran and Pakistan sent missiles to each other's territories. Iranians hit what they called a terrorist base inside Pakistan. And 2 weeks later, Pakistan retaliated. And any other country that attacks the other one with cruise missiles, there would be major tensions within days. Iran and Pakistan patched up their differences. Ambassadors went back and everything is back to normal. And just yesterday, they announced a major trade deal with one another. Iran and Azerbaijan have tensions. Again, Iran has gone out of its way to reduce those tensions. Of course, in March of 2023, tensions with Saudi Arabia were resolved. Ambassadors were exchanged. Earlier in 2021, Iran-UAE relations improved. And so this good neighborly relations, ironically, has produced some results. And you might be wondering why. And maybe I'm just cynical, but my assumption is that Raisi does not have domestic legitimacy. You might remember about a year and a half ago, Iran was racked by major protests and people don't like him. He doesn't have electoral legitimacy. And so the one place where he can have some legitimacy, the one thing that he can say, look, I've done something, is in the area of foreign policy. In terms of look east, which has had tangible results, Iran is now a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's a member of the BRICS. It's now, it's of course selling drones to Russia. Apparently over the last couple of weeks, there are reports that Iran has been sending precision missiles to Russia. So the Lucist policy is delivering, and of course, the good neighborly relations are delivering. But there's also one other thing that we cannot ignore in terms of the way Tehran sees the world around it. And it sees itself surrounded. It sees itself surrounded by American footprints around the world. If you think of where American military presence is, if you get a map of the Middle East and put a star in every place where the United States has a military base, and you sit in Tehran and you look around you, you will see that you're actually surrounded. And there is some logic, there is some justification. This map is old because it has American bases in Afghanistan. So for a minute, pretend those stars in Afghanistan don't exist. But you know what? I'm not trying to make excuses for Iranian policymakers. They excel. The Iranian policymakers excel at shooting themselves in the foot. The Iranian state is Iran's worst enemy. But there is something to be said about their assumption of being surrounded by the American military. And here is a visual impact of it. Now, what this tells me is that there's going to be continued tension in the Middle East. The Americans aren't going anywhere. Those stars aren't disappearing. And the Iranians aren't suddenly going to say, you know what, we're going to embrace the United States and American foreign policy. So from as a student of the region, I look at this and I say, there's going to be tensions in the foreseeable future. Unless there's a win-win scenario, I first heard the term win-win scenario in relation to the Persian Gulf in Tehran. I haven't heard it since. And the guy who told me has now kind of gone over to the dark side. He's no longer in search of a win-win scenario with the Americans. All right. By way of conclusion, what does this tell us? Everything that we have seen, the world from regional capitals, the world from Tehran, from Doha, Riyadh, Abu Dhabi, from Washington, what does this tell us about where we are and the region that we've been talking about? Well, I started out by saying we're at the gates of historic change, and we very, very well might be. Some of this is because of what I talked about. Some of this is because things happening outside of the Persian Gulf, over which the Persian Gulf itself has no control. But we're seeing that the Houthis are, of course, doing something about it. Interestingly, incidentally, you might remember that in October, the Houthis came out and criticized Iran. Why isn't Iran doing anything about the Palestinians? And the Houthis came out and said, if Iran doesn't do anything about the Palestinians, we're going to do it ourselves. I am not familiar with the rhetoric and the narrative about the Gaza war outside of in Europe. I don't know how the French see it. In the Middle East, people see what's happening in Gaza as ethnic cleansing and genocide. I know those are not comfortable terms, but that's the way people see it, and that's bound to have consequences for the way that things are going to occur. Now, of course, there's the war in Gaza that has unpredictable and unintended consequences, but also unpredictable is the very nature of the political systems that are there. autocracies do whatever necessary to save themselves, even if they have to engage in the mother of all battles. You might remember Saddam Hussein's rallying cry, mother of all battles. So they would do anything to save themselves. Saudi Arabia, even Iran, United Arab Emirates. If regime survival is in jeopardy, autocracies behave in quite unpredictable manner. Now, unfortunately, we all die at some point, even if we are supreme leaders, even if we are supreme commanders. And the Iranian supreme leader, by the way, there's no such term in Iran as supreme leader. He's known simply as leader. Supreme leader is a term of journalistic convenience that Western journalists picked up because it looks ominous. And if you watched one of Steven Spielberg's latest Star Wars, there's an evil character called Supreme Leader. So it's convenient and we call him Supreme Leader. But anyway, even that guy dies, whatever his title might be. He's 84 and Iran is bound to have a different, not political system, but certainly a different leadership. And in the Q&A, I might, if you'd like, we could talk about that. And right now, if I were European, I would really prepare myself for a return of the Donald. Now, it's still early days. We don't know what's going to happen, but the American president, the incumbent, is not helping himself. His election is in trouble. And you might remember that 2 days ago in South Carolina, Donald Trump beat his Republican opponent, Nikki Haley. She was the governor of South Carolina, and he's on despite everything, it seems like he's unstoppable, Donald Trump. Now, we'll have to wait and see. Now, I say this because I do want to say something about American presidential elections. Historically, American presidents have engaged in what you might think of as heroic diplomacy in the seventh year of their second year in office. Let me repeat that. Historically, American presidents have engaged in heroic diplomacy in the seventh year of their second term in office. When they win re-election, seventh year, they do interesting things. Look at the two-term presidents. From Obama, who signed the Iran deal, to G.W. Bush, who became different, George W. Bush, who became a different person, traveled to Africa, to even Ronald Reagan, who every one of these guys. Why? Because the first year is honeymoon. When they become first elected, first year the American president is in honeymoon. Second year, there's congressional elections. They don't want to be responsible. Third and fourth year, there's their own re-election. Then sixth year, if they get re-elected, sixth year, there's still congressional election. Then seventh year, they become concerned about their legacy. They become concerned about the historic legacy. And they do things that they haven't done for 6 or 7 years. If Biden gets reelected, I am willing to bet, I'll buy everybody here dinner, that if he gets reelected, so it's a safe bet, if he gets reelected, he's going to pursue a different foreign policy than he has done up until now. His foreign policy is likely to be somewhat different. I don't know how, but it is going to be a different foreign policy in the same way that Obama's was different, Clinton's was different. George W. Bush's was different. All of these people. So it would be interesting to see how the election turns out. Having said all of this, we're likely to see some continuities in one form or another. The American military presence will continue to be robust. Every year we see more and more American military sales in the region. Military-military relations remain quite robust. And because of America's continued military presence and continued military attention, we're still likely to see continued continued tensions. Of course, the Americans and the Iranians, I don't think will have the courage to come up with win-win scenarios. It's easy to continue to hurl insults at each other. And of course, I think they're going to continue doing that while two peoples suffer. The Yemenis will continue to suffer and the Palestinians will continue to suffer. Of course, you hear the term, there's an African proverb that says, when elephants fight, the grass suffers. And unfortunately, the people of the Middle East and the Yemenis and the Palestinians in particular are likely to suffer. I hate to end the talk on a sad note, but unfortunately, we're likely to see continued tensions in the foreseeable future. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you. Right.